Happy New Year. This is Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story comes from Indian Country Today, ICT, by Shabeli Carazana. Tucked in New Mexico's new universal child care program is a less talked about provision that could expand access to free child care for some of the state's most vulnerable caregivers, grandparents. In most cities and states, child care is designed to help support working parents, and so caregivers need to prove they are working or going to school to access subsidized care. That's the way it had been in New Mexico until government officials started asking families across the state about their child care needs. Again and again, for the past 2 years, they heard from grandparents who are raising grandchildren. Because most were retired, they didn't meet the work or school qualifications to receive any of the government assistance the state was offering. Grandparents who were finding themselves once again in the role of parent lacked the financial support or even the physical ability to provide that caregiving. New Mexico has the highest share of children in kinship care of any state. Between 2021 and 2023, 8% of kids in New Mexico were being raised by grandparents or other kin, more than double the national average of 3%. And that percentage has been going up, according to a report from the Los Alamos National Laboratory, LANL, Foundation, which supports public education and community development in 7 counties and 18 tribal nations. The state has been roiled by a substance abuse epidemic that affects about 16% of the adult non-senior population. In 2021, New Mexico ranked first in alcohol deaths and sixth in drug overdose deaths, according to LANL's report. That is a large part of the reason many grandparents are stepping in to take over children's care. But those grandparents are also struggling financially. According to LANL, 1 in 3 are living at or below the poverty level. That's at a rate that is also almost twice the national average in a state where the average annual cost of childcare is $13,500 for center-based care and $11,500 for home-based care. The substantial share of grandparents caring for grandkids was a problem that the state was uniquely positioned to address as it formulated its new universal child care program, which launched last month with the aim of making child care free for all kids. The way the new regulations are written, grandparents with legal custody or kinship guardianship are specifically exempt from work and school requirements, making them now newly eligible for free child care. We wanted grandparents to see that we see them and that what we recognize they are doing heroes work by taking care of their grandchildren, said Elizabeth Groginski, New Mexico's Cabinet Secretary for Early Childhood Education. New Mexico is not the first state to give grandparents an exemption from work restrictions so they can access child care assistance. 21 states have some variation of an exemption for kinship caregivers, said Grace Reif, the president of the Early Learning Policy Group and an expert in child care policy who has analyzed all of the state exemptions. But those exemptions are often tucked into a complicated part of the law that may make it difficult for families to understand that they even qualify. And no other state is offering anything as robust as universal care. New Mexico's approach is simpler and more universally applicable to grandparents, helping reduce confusion and barriers for grandparents seeking child care access for their family, said Ann Hegepeth, the Senior Vice President of Policy and Research at Child Care Aware of America, a national child care advocacy organization. Groginski said the population of New Mexico's universal program has also helped more residents become more aware of the options available to them. New Mexico became the first state to offer free child care this year, one of the most high-profile child care launches in the United States. The state has been preparing for this step over the course of years, establishing a fund in 2020 with money earmarked for early childhood education. Thanks to tax collections from the oil and gas industries, the fund has grown from $320 million to $10 billion. Latinas in New Mexico helped pass a constitutional amendment in 2022 that ensured a portion of a second state fund went specifically to universal child care. What happens now in this state is expected to become a model for others to follow. Already, proposals for universal child care are being considered in New York and Georgia. Following New Mexico's example, states could choose to include grandparents. Nationwide, the share of grandparents caring for grandkids has been growing for the past 25 years, driven in part by the opioid epidemic. About 916 children from grandparent-led households received child care assistance in the fiscal year 2025. In the 3 weeks since universal child care launched in New Mexico, 61 new grandparent-headed households have applied and have been approved to receive funds. Giovanna Archuleta, the Early Childhood Program Director at LANL, said what grandparents repeatedly expressed to them was the need for options. If the state can build up the number of providers, it will then need the staff to run the expanded system. In addition to maintaining its current staffing levels, the state is projecting having to recruit at least 5,000 more educators. Part of the universal program includes higher reimbursement rates for providers that commit to paying staff at least $16 an hour. To achieve the ramp-up to universal care, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is expected to request an additional $120 million from the state legislature next year for the program, a tall ask as the state faces budget shortfalls next year due to cuts in Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP. Already, states across the country have been cutting their child care budgets because of those budget pressures. It's an ambitious plan, but if it's designed in a way that is responsive to the true needs of families, with expansive definition of family that considers the role grandparents play, then it can be a model that's worth perfecting, said Natalie Renew, the executive director of Homegrown, a national group working to expand home-based care access. If we are going to invest a huge amount of money into a universal child care system, let's hold an ambitious goal for what it delivers to families, Renew said. I don't think it's going to be easy, but I think it is possible, and I really want the sector to be in this problem-solving mode with them. What do you need to figure this out? Up next, Cherokee Nation proposes $30 million OU Nursing School Partnership to Expand Health Workforce by Anna Discoy. From Native News Online. Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Cherokee National Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. and Deputy Chief Brian Warner proposed Monday to earmark $30 million for a satellite nursing school campus in Tahlequah through a partnership with the University of Oklahoma. The legislation also aims to invest millions annually to train more nurses and other healthcare professionals for jobs in the Cherokee Nation and rural Oklahoma. We cannot create a world-class system of wellness if we do not maximize our healthcare workforce, said Chief Hoskin. The package sent to the council to consider is a generational investment to ensure we have Cherokees entering the healthcare professions in record numbers now and deep into the 21st century. Chief Hoskin and Deputy Chief Warner proposed several measures under their 21st Century Cherokee Healthcare Workforce Plan, including $30 million for a new University of Oklahoma College of Nursing satellite campus at the Cherokee National Nursing and Allied Health Education Center, through a remodel of the current W.W. Hastings Hospital facility, which will be replaced by a new hospital by mid-2026. More than $5 million for a Cherokee Nursing and Allied Health Scholarship Endowment to provide perpetual student aid to Cherokee Nation citizens on a payback basis through employment in the tribe's health system. $1 million annually for a new Health Field College Scholarship and Youth Career Exploration Program through the tribe's Education Services Department. and $1 million annually for non-degree health career training grants through the tribe's Career Services Department. This plan is a win for the entire region and a great near-term and long-term health workforce strategy for Cherokee Nation, said Deputy Chief Warner. Partnering with OU means we will bring world-class nursing education to everyone, generate nursing graduates to serve everyone in the region, and put more Cherokees than ever in a position to find a career path in the healthcare field. The Cherokee Nation Nursing and Allied Health Education Center and Endowment Act authorizes the tribe to partner with a third-party collegiate provider. Chief Hoskin and Deputy Chief Warner announced the tribe is in talks with OU to operate the new center. We deeply value the Cherokee Nation's leadership and vision in strengthening the healthcare workforce in Oklahoma. Strengthening Oklahoma's healthcare workforce is a core pillar of the University of Oklahoma's strategic plan, said University of Oklahoma President Joseph Harris, Jr. As the state's flagship university, we are proud to collaborate with tribal nations to expand access to high-quality nursing education. The proposed law would provide $5.15 million in an endowment for nursing and allied health education through the Cherokee Nation Foundation scholarships, which will be open to Cherokees nationwide, with a preference given to students who aim to join the tribe's health workforce. The main goal with the new endowment is to create a perpetual source of funds to send Cherokees, no matter where they live, to get their education at low or no cost and pay the tribe back by joining our amazing healthcare workforce, said Cherokee Nation Chief of Staff Dr. Corey Bunch. Chief Hoskin and Deputy Chief Warner also proposed tapping $2 million annually from the tribe's Public Health and Wellness Fund Act for health career education and training. Proposed amendments to the Comprehensive Scholarship Act would direct $1 million annually to health field scholarships and youth career exploration, while amendments to the Career Readiness Act would allocate $1 million annually for non-degree health care training and expand services beyond the reservation. These investments are in addition to the millions already provided annually for scholarships and job training. Last year, scholarship funding totaled nearly $25 million, career training support exceeded $12 million, and the Cherokee Nation Foundation awarded $550,000 in scholarships. The Council of the Cherokee Nation will consider the legislation later this month. The council has helped shape a great deal of health and education policy and funding in recent years, but this may be one of the most impactful investments we've played a role in, said Speaker of the Council Johnny Jack Kidwell. If approved, the $30 million remodel of the W.W. Hastings facility will begin after hospital operations move in the summer of 2026 to the tribe's new $450 million hospital on the same campus. Nursing cohorts are expected to begin online in fall 2026, with the remodeled facility opening in 2027. Cherokee Nation operates the largest health system in Indian Country, providing more than 3 million patient services per year to members of every federally recognized tribe. You're listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up next, from the Arizona Republic, What Tree Rings Tell Us About How Tribes Managed Fire, by Sarah Henry. For those who can read them, tree rings offer a glimpse into the past. Christopher Ruse is one of those people, and he's using them to shed light on a story that reveals how Western Apache tribes have long used fire to shape their environment, insights that offer a strategy for fire management practices today. The Apache record is really amazing, said Ruse, who has a PhD in anthropology and is an environmental archaeologist and professor of anthropology at Southern Methodist University in Texas. The burn scars evident on the spiraling rings of ponderosa pines and conifers in Arizona forests show an approach that fundamentally altered the landscape. The way the Western Apache burned significantly reduced the effect drought and other climatic factors had on fire activity. They disconnected the whole machine of climate driving fire, he said. Looking at tree ring records dating back to the 1600s, Ruse partnered with researchers in Kansas and California to study how the Western Apache used small and frequent fires to clear foliage off the forest floor and mitigate large-scale wildfires. Fire has always played a role in forests. It recycles nutrients, promotes plant growth, and supports habitats, according to Peter Foulet, a professor in the Department of Forestry at Northern Arizona University. Prescribed fire, as we think of it now, is part of that system. But fire as a tool for stewardship goes beyond that. Indigenous tribes have long used fire to care for the land through cultural burnings. But in the 1800s, that practice was banned by restrictive and discriminatory laws in places like California. Now fire researchers, managers, and practitioners are looking to it for answers. Indigenous fire stewardship is a bridge between history and the present. It's both an ancient practice and a viable current wildfire mitigation tool, said Melinda Adams, Ph.D., a San Carlos Apache fire scientist at the University of Kansas and an author on the study. An approach like the Western Apaches is one that is increasingly important now as climate change spurs warmer and drier conditions that make for more active wildfire season. Small and fragmented burns, what Ruse calls a mosaic of fire, could be more effective at diminishing risk and buffering the effects of climate than bigger, cohesive prescribed burns. But the research also echoes what indigenous communities have known for centuries, that fire management isn't about avoiding disaster, it's about cultivating the land. Where there's thunder, there's lightning and fire, and people starting fires. Climate-fueled wildfires in Arizona aren't uncommon. Drought and lightning pose significant risk and always have. Fires in the central and eastern regions of Arizona were so frequent, Ruse said, that it's difficult to pinpoint on tree rings exactly which fires were started by people and which weren't. The most troubling part about that to me was the idea that you wouldn't be able to see it. It probably didn't matter. He said, I didn't agree with that second statement. If it was impossible to tell the difference between human-made fire and climate-made fire, then the team would approach the problem in a new way, by looking at the effects of historic indigenous burnings. That's where we would learn some really important things about contemporary fire management, he said. Researchers examined 649 fire-scarred trees from unpublished fire history work done 25 years ago across the traditional Western Apache territory. Looking at alternating variation in wide and narrow tree rings, they were able to date fire events to the year, to the growing season, and sometimes even to the month. What they found was that during times when the land was used by native people most intensively, climate had very little influence on fire activity. The Western Apache were mainly foragers and hunters, Ruse said. They moved across the region with the season to gather food. Tree ring data shows that fires in the Apache territory during this period followed their schedule, not a schedule driven by drought or lightning. The study builds on Ruse's previous research examining how good fire can be used to abate climate-fueled wildfires today. Returning fire to the land restores health to the ecosystem. As catastrophic megafires become more common in the West, a different approach to managing fire and a different relationship to fire might just be what forests need. We live in a culture of fire suppression, Adams says. Now agencies, landowners, and everyday people are grappling with what it means and looking to rebuild a more holistic fire culture. Historic public campaigns have convinced the public that all fire is bad. Think of Smokey Bear, Ruse said, the furry-friendly warning face seen across the West. But a long history of suppression hasn't just led to the wildfires that rage across California and other states. It has also stifled native fire stewardship and those effects can be seen far and wide. Cultural burns carried out by Indigenous practitioners fulfill a myriad of needs. Management fires, what we think about as prescribed fires, really only have one goal, to reduce hazard, Ruud says. Cultural burns are usually conducted for positive reasons rather than removing something negative, he said. Burning small patchworks not only helps temper the effects of climate on wildfire events, but it can also foster forest diversity. When the fire is returned to landscapes, it creates a heterogeneous ecosystem and lots of plant diversity, Adams said. In turn, that diversity makes forests more resilient to wildfire. Now temperatures are increasing, summers are getting longer, and rain is coming less frequently. Like the prescription of conditions that makes a day right for a burn, these are the ingredients that make a recipe for wildfire, and those fires are felt across the country. Smoke from major fires carries on the wind over state boundaries. That smoke contains fine particulate matter that can lodge in the lungs and create issues for people with underlying respiratory problems. Either way, our future is fire, Adams says. We have an opportunity to approach how we rebuild our relationship with fire, suppression to stewardship. We have to change. A different approach to fire management. Across the state this month, fire managers with the U.S. Forest Service and the State Forestry Department are taking advantage of the Goldilocks kind of just-right conditions. Conditions have aligned for the perfect opportunity to burn. We really try to utilize our time and these windows of opportunity to put some good fire on the ground and reduce the wildfire risk across the state, said Tiffany Davila, who works as the public affairs officer at the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management. They have to jump on the chance because they aren't sure when it might come again. Climate change is shrinking the window of time agencies are able to carry out prescribed fires. A 2023 study showed that longer, warmer summers could axe suitable days for burns by 17%, and that states in the Southwest will bear the brunt of that loss. There are some real constraints for federal and state agencies. Anytime they get an opportunity to burn, they want to get access, Ruud said. That's most easily done in a contiguous fashion. But that's not the geography or spatial pattern by which cultural burns happen. Prescribed burns like those done by state and federal agencies are beneficial, he emphasized. They protect homes and help manage fire severity. And he said there needs to be a lot more of it. But there's a benefit to cultural burns that the tree rings reveal, greater climate resiliency. Fire stewardship lends itself to being a current and adaptable practice. It's also a prime example of how indigenous knowledge is a science, Adams said. The stakes are high. If we continue on the trajectory we're on, we are going to lose our forests, Ruud said. Still, he and Adams are hopeful that what the tree rings show and what indigenous tribes have known could help reimagine the way we interact with fire today. Sarah Henry covers environmental issues for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Environmental coverage on azcentral.com and in the Arizona Republic is supported by a grant from the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust. Up next, Red Lake Man Kidnapped by ICE, from Native News Online, by Neely Bardwell. Early Thursday morning, a Red Lake Nation descendant and U.S. citizen, Jose Roberto Ramirez, 20, was detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE agents, in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, a suburb of Minneapolis. The encounter was posted on Facebook by a relative. The arrest came just a day after an ICE agent fatally shot U.S. citizen Renee Nicole Good in Minneapolis during a separate immigration enforcement operation. Ramirez, who was born in Minneapolis, called his aunt, Shantina Sosa Clara, after he realized he was being followed by a federal agent. He pulled into a Hy-Vee parking lot in Robbinsdale, and Sosa Clara met him there, then called Robbinsdale police. Only ICE agents were involved in the detention, and Robbinsdale Police Captain John Elder said his officers had nothing to do with the arrest. Our officers had no interactions with the detainee. Ramirez's mother, Raylan Duffy, who is an enrolled tribal member of the Red Lake Nation, said her son is a U.S. citizen. She brought his passport and birth certificate to the B.H. Whipple Federal Building near Fort Snelling in an attempt to prove his citizenship, but she was initially turned away and could not contact him for several hours. Sosa Clara said in the video that after agents surrounded the vehicle, she estimated there were about 20 agents. She began live streaming the interaction. She said agents tried to scan Ramirez's face for identification, and that at one point an agent punched him and multiple agents hit him. The Star Tribune account does report that agents struck Ramirez during the encounter. Sosa Clara also said she handed Ramirez his driver's license when agents demanded identification, but it was lost amid the commotion. Duffy said a lawyer planned to meet her at the Whipple Building when it reopened Friday morning. According to statements from Minnesota legislators, Ramirez was not initially allowed to show proof of citizenship at the time of his arrest. Ramirez was released from ICE custody later Thursday afternoon. As of Friday, there were no announced assault charges. Chairman Steve Sitting Bear of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe issued a statement reminding tribal citizens to carry identification such as tribal ID cards or degrees of Indian blood and reiterated that tribal members are U.S. citizens and that our members are not immigrants, subject to immigration enforcement on sovereign tribal lands. In our final story, Navajo Nation Council Delegate Stephen Arviso resigns, by Native News Online staff. Stephen R. Arviso resigned from the 25th Navajo Nation Council effective January 9, 2026, to focus on his family and personal pursuits. Arviso had served on the council since January 2023, representing the communities of Church Rock, Iabito, Mariano Lake, Pinedale, Smith Lake, and Thoreau. I am grateful to have served the people of my delegate region and thank everyone who supported me throughout my service, Arviso said. Together we work to advance important initiatives that will continue beyond my time on the council. During his tenure, Arviso served on the Law and Order Committee and as vice chair of the Eastern Navajo Land Commission. We are grateful for Delegate Arviso's service and commitment to the Navajo people, said Speaker Crystalline Curley. His leadership and dedication have made a positive impact, and we wish him and his family well moving forward. Under the Navajo Election Code, once the Navajo Election Administration declares a vacancy, the Speaker has the authority to appoint an interim delegate to fill the seat with the recommendation of the affected chapters. The deadline for the chapters to submit a recommendation through an official resolution is 5 p.m. Thursday, February 26, 2026. Each recommended individual must also file a candidate application and ethics clearance with the Navajo Election Administration, which will review the applications and certify eligible candidates. If no grievances are filed within 10 days after certification, the resolutions and candidate applications will be forwarded to the Speaker for review and appointment. You've been listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Land Back by Hallucination. If you miss a program on Sun Sounds, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.